What avails love when life is so ephemeral? What avails a mortal's love for the immortal? A flickering spark I am, a glow for a fleeting glance, flow vain for a flickering spark to chase an eternal flame. You are listening to Western Worlds. Hello, and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Dr. John, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University, located in London, Ontario, Canada, from which the tracks of four fireballs have been seen since 2008. If you take the time to sit back, relax, and stare up at the night sky for a while, you'll notice that the moon, the planets, the stars, and the galaxies aren't alone. Upon the stage of the sky, there are brilliant players who periodically intrude to strut a bright streak across the heavens and then are seen no more. Much like the flickering spark described by the poet Allama Iqbal in our opening quote, there is a deeper meaning to these meteors than meets even the most fleeting glance of our eye. From the path they take, we can determine whether the dust motes we see burning up in the high atmosphere are from our own solar system, or whether they come to us from beyond the sun. As you might expect, catching such embers in the act is technically challenging. However, researchers here at Western University, such as tonight's subject, Dr. Margaret Campbell Brown, have succeeded in building a network of monitoring stations. Their cameras are capable of capturing that fleeting glance from multiple angles, which allows the path of a meteor to be traced. Sometimes, those cameras and other instruments observe and track something larger. Fireballs may form as less coherent bodies fragment explosively, and meteorites trace their fiery fall to the ground. Along with particles too small to burn, these objects are a tangible link between our Earth and the greater universe. Hundreds of tons of this material sprinkles down on us every year, a sort of cosmic rain, seeding the surface of our planet and the others in our system with carbon-rich substances whose only visible evidence is through those bright streaks in the night. Allow me to leave you with that thought as we transition through Mike Oldfield's appropriately titled The Tempest to Alyssa Gilbert's interview of Dr. Campbell Brown.
So thank you for doing this interview with us with Western Worlds. So of course you're interested in studying the sporadic meteoroid complex and how meteoroids interact with the atmosphere, but maybe we can start with some more basic stuff for our listeners. What is a meteoroid and how are they different from meteors and meteorites?
Well, a meteoroid is an object that orbits the sun in the solar system. It's bigger than a grain of dust and smaller than an asteroid or comet, and the exact limit people discuss it, something like smaller than 50 meters. And the ones that I study are more like a centimeter size. These little objects aren't left over from the formation of the solar system. They're actually part of comets or asteroids that have broken up somehow through collisions or comets thrown off dust and things like that. And so they've come off within the last, say, 100,000 years from these larger solar system bodies, and they're circling the sun. Now, if a meteoroid collides with a planet like the Earth that has an atmosphere, the meteoroid basically burns up in the atmosphere, and the streak of light that we see then is called a meteor. If the object is very large, say larger than about 10 centimeters, it might make it all the way through the atmosphere and land on the ground. And in that case, we call it a meteorite. And those things we can pick up and study in the lab.
So you talked a bit about how some of these come from comets, but some of them come from asteroids. Can you talk a little bit about kind of the locations from where these objects come and where those objects are in our solar system?
So there's basically three main sources of meteors that hit the Earth. One is objects from the asteroid asteroid belt, and most of the very bright fireballs, the sudden fireballs that people see that sort of light up the sky, cast shadows on the ground, most of those seem to come from asteroids. So those are pieces of asteroids that have been knocked off in collisions that have then had their orbits changed so that they hit the Earth, and those are the ones most likely to make meteorites. In the smaller size range, it looks like most of that material comes from comets, and there are two types of comets. One type is a type with a very short orbit that orbits sort of inside the orbit of Jupiter, and these are called Jupiter family comets, and debris from those ones is a very major component of the material that hits the Earth every day. And the other component is long period comets. This is like Comet Halley. Comet Halley actually has two meteor showers associated with it, and there are probably many more meteors that happen throughout the year that actually were born from Comet Halley, but then had their orbits changed so they can no longer be recognized as belonging to Comet Halley. And most of the sporadic meteors that we see come from comets, both long period and short period, and have just had their orbits changed so much by various forces, by encounters with the planets, by radiation from the sun, so that they no longer look, the orbits no longer look like the parent bodies. And so these hit the Earth every day. At the rate, if you go out on a clear and dark night, you can see about 20 of these things hit the Earth every hour. And that's even on nights where there aren't meteor showers. And the meteor showers are nights when we run through the path of debris that's been left behind by a comet. So, for example, the Perseids in August are material left behind from Comet Swift-Tuttle. And every year we pass by close to the orbit of the comet, and we see this debris which is spread out around the orbit of that comet every year.
And there's a nice meteor stream in December as well, right?
That's right. The Geminids is actually a better shower than the Perseids, and the reason it's not so well known is that the weather is generally terrible in December, both because it's cold and it's cloudy. A much nicer shower if you can get out and see it around the middle of December, but the weather is not so pleasant as for the Perseids in August.
And about how many meteor showers are there known?
Well, that's a question that actually the International Astronomical Union is working on right now.
Okay.
They have a working list of meteor showers which contains about 250.
Oh, wow.
But some of these are based on only maybe three or four meteors that someone saw on one particular night that seem to have a similar orbit. And so some of these are almost certainly just a chance. There happened to be a bunch of meteors at the same time. So the IAU is actually working on determining which ones are really meteor showers and which ones are not. So there's maybe 120 that are very well confirmed. And then another group of showers that they might be real showers that only happen every few years. That every year the Earth may not pass through the material, and just maybe every 10 years or 20 years there's enough material to create a shower. And some of them may be just chance associations that if we observe for longer we'll find that they're not really there at all.
And the ones that, the major ones that we know of, like the Perseids and the Leonids and the Geminids, are all named of course from what's called the radiant, right?
Right.
Where they appear to come from in the sky.
Right. So meteor showers, the meteoroids in a meteoroid stream that makes a meteor shower, they're all traveling sort of in parallel paths. They're all on the same orbit. And so when they hit the Earth, they're all traveling in the same direction. When you look up in the sky, though, you don't see them coming in next to each other. It's like when you look at train tracks and they seem to converge on a point in the distance. The same thing when you look at meteors that are coming into the sky. They all seem to be coming from a common point in the sky. And so we take the constellation that they appear to be coming from, and we name them after that. So the Perseids after Perseus, the Geminids after Gemini, and so on.
So those are, of course, the ones people are most familiar with, but you're very interested in the sporadic meteors. So could you tell us more about those and maybe your research on that?
There are meteors, as I said, that hit the Earth every day, not just during meteor showers. And these are meteors that we don't know their parent objects because their orbits have been changed since they were released from their parent bodies. And these ones are actually very interesting for a number of reasons. For one thing, it actually tells us something about the history of comets and asteroids in the solar system. Now, we tend to think that the comets that we see now have always been there and are always going to be there. But in fact, the number of comets in the inner solar system changes all the time. The orbits of comets are changing all the time. Some comets are destroyed if they get too close to the sun or if they get too close to Jupiter. They might crash into Jupiter or be thrown out of the solar system. New comets can come into the inner solar system from far from the Oort cloud, which is very far from the sun, from the Kuiper belt, which is a little closer to the sun, but still past the orbit of Neptune. And new objects can come into the solar system when they have a close encounter with a planet or something like that that changes their orbit so that they come in. If we look at the meteoroids that were created tens or hundreds of thousands of years ago, we can get some idea of what kinds of comets were around in the solar system at that time that may not be around in our time.
does that give us an idea of maybe how the solar system formed in general, or?
Right. So it can tell us how the solar system formed, how it evolves. The solar system is actually still evolving. Again, we tend to think of the planets as being kind of fixed where they are, but in fact, everything is constantly moving. Everything is constantly being tweaked because there are so many objects in our solar system. They all have gravitational forces on each other, and that can change the orbits of everything slightly. And so all of these things can affect comets and asteroids and can tell us about how things were in the solar system in the past.
So when you're observing these objects, is there a way to figure out if they're from an asteroid or from a comet?
The first thing we look at is their orbits, and we try to figure out whether they have, if they're coming at the Earth from the sort of the North Pole or the South Pole, from far outside the ecliptic plane where most of the planets are, we know that they're probably not from an asteroid, because it's very hard to take something that's in an orbit that's in the plane for all the other planets and to move it so that suddenly it's outside the plane. So that probably came from a comet from the Oort cloud that has an orbit already out of the plane of the ecliptic. So the orbit is the first thing we look at. On the other hand, the orbit can also fool us, because we have some objects that are on orbits like asteroids, close to the Earth, but they probably started out as Jupiter family comets and just have had their orbits changed by the radiation from the sun and so on. And so the orbit doesn't tell us the whole story. The other thing that we want to look at is what the meteoroids are made out of, and that's a big part of my research. So we look at the meteoroids and we try to see whether they are fragile or solid. We try to see what sort of elements are in them, especially metals like iron, sodium, magnesium, and so on. And these sorts of things can tell us something about where they come from. We don't know exactly what yet, so we're still working on what pieces of asteroids look like when they burn up in the atmosphere, what pieces of comets look like. If we look at them, we look how far down in the atmosphere they get. That tells us something about how strong they are. If they're very fragile, then they'll break into pieces and finish much higher in the atmosphere than something that's solid and strong. We can also look at the spectrum they produce, and we can look at the little lines in their spectrum and see what sort of metals are in there. We can even do a model of how they ablate in the atmosphere and try to figure out how dense they are. Are they as dense as ice, or are they as dense as iron, or something in between, and try to figure out what they're made out of in this way. The objects this small never make it to the ground, and so we can't actually look at them in the lab. And in fact, there's only material from one comet and one asteroid that's been returned to the Earth, and in both cases it was very, very tiny material. So the Stardust mission got material from comet Vilt 2 and brought it back to the Earth, and it's very interesting because this comet includes material that obviously formed very close to the sun, somewhere that was very, very hot. Mm. But the comet itself must have formed far from the sun because it's got lots of ice in it. It formed where it was very, very cold. And so the question is, how did this material that formed where it was hot get to where the comet was? The other question is, do we see any larger chunks of this solid material? And so we can't tell that from a sample return mission yet because the sample detector just isn't big enough to collect these much less common big particles. So the only way we can study these bigger chunks of comets is to watch them in the atmosphere. For asteroids, some material has been returned from asteroid Itokawa by the spacecraft Hayabusa. But again, this was tiny, tiny grains, much, much smaller than a millimeter. And so we want to know, how does that relate to meteorites in the lab, and how does that relate to the sort of millimeter-sized grains that we see burning up in the atmosphere?
I mean, obviously, when they come through the atmosphere, it's a lot more complicated than it just burning up, right? There's a lot of things going on that happen when it comes through the atmosphere.
It's very complicated. So in a lot of our models, we assume that the meteor is just a ball, a round sphere that comes through the atmosphere, and it's made of one particular thing, metal or stone or something like that. But in fact, the truth must be more complicated. If you look at meteorites, they're not just made of little spheres of material. There's lots of different clays and little grains of iron, little grains of sulfides, little grains of all kinds of different minerals. And so the objects that we're seeing are almost certainly clusters of different grains of different compositions. They're probably not spherical. They probably have some strange shape. We know that many of them break up as they come into the atmosphere, so they change their shape. And so all of these things, we have to try to figure out what's going on when we do that. It's much too easy to model a meteor. It's very easy to find some combination of things that will match the sort of light that you see coming out of it and the how it slows down. But when you look closely, you'll find there's actually lots of different models that could match it, and you don't know which one is the right one. So one thing that I've done recently is to build a meteor camera that has a pair of mirrors that move really, really fast. They can slew across the whole sky in much less than a second. We use these mirrors and a computer to track meteors as they go across the sky. So we take the light from the meteor and we put it into a telescope. The telescope gives us a very close-up view of the meteor as it's burning up in the sky. And so we can see when it breaks into many pieces. We can count the pieces. We can see how the pieces are moving individually. We can even take the spectrum of each individual piece. And so that gives us a much better idea what's going on, and it gives us much better constraints for our models. us when we're trying to figure out what's happening to the meteor as it goes through the atmosphere, and we can try to figure out what that meteoroid is made out of.
So here at Western, we have quite a large group that works on similar research. Could you tell us maybe more about that and the instruments that we have here and how it all kind of connects together?
Sure. Well, my own program looks at meteors mostly optically. So we look at the light that the meteors produce. We have a pair of fixed cameras that look at the same part of the sky, and they just observe the meteors that come through the field of view. They're video cameras, so we can see how the meteor moves in time. We can measure that. We can get the orbits of the meteors, their light curves. We can try to figure out how many of them are hitting the Earth and where they come from. Then we have the mirror system that I mentioned. We have two of those mirror systems, so in fact we can look at the meteor from two different angles, and we can get a sort of three-dimensional picture of the fragmentation and so on. And those systems run automatically any clear night at two sites just north of the university. We also have a network of all sky cameras, and these cameras look for very bright meteors, especially ones that might potentially drop meteorites. And so this is looking at a much larger population of objects that are larger than 1 centimeter to tens of centimeters. Those ones include more asteroidal material that might make it to the Earth, and those sorts of things. We also have a meteor radar, and the radar can observe the streak of ionization. When the meteor goes through the atmosphere, it leaves behind a little trail of electrons from all the atoms that have been ionized as the meteor passed by, and the radar can scatter off of these trails. And the radar actually sees 5,000 orbits a day, so it sees many, many orbits of meteors. The radar is not very precise. We can't really see what's going on as the meteor ablates, but we can see where the meteor comes from. And because we have 5,000 a day, we can build up a very good picture of where the meteors are coming from that are hitting the Earth. And the other good thing about the radar is it can run during the day, which the optical systems can't, and it can run when it's cloudy, which the optical systems can't, and in London it's cloudy a lot. So the radar does very good work for us. Another system we have is an infrasound system. So meteors, when they come low enough in the atmosphere, very large meteors, they can produce sound waves. And the sound waves, sometimes they can actually be audible. You can hear a rumble like thunder after a very bright fireball. But more often, there's sound waves that you can't hear. They're too low frequency. And these low frequency sounds can be picked up by very sensitive microphones. And we have a set of these microphones just north of the university, and we can actually hear the signal that comes from these very bright meteors. So what we do is we observe the meteor with the all-sky cameras, and then we listen for the sound with the infrasound. The sound can tell us something about how big the meteoroid was as it was coming in. It gives us another way of checking that.
So it's a very diverse group of instruments that really helps you constrain what's going on with these meteors. And instead of just having one system or the other, having kind of the suite of them is really helpful.
Right. Because we can't hold these things in our hands and look at them in the lab, we're stuck with whatever they give us, the light, the ionization, and that sort of thing. So the more things we can look at, the better we can know each meteoroid.
The infrasound, I heard, has picked up some other interesting sounds from a grow-up or whatever, meth lab blowing up. And
the infrasound can actually hear Niagara Falls.
Oh, wow.
Constantly. When the space shuttle was launching, it could hear the space shuttle take off. Several hours after the space shuttle, it would get the wave. It can hear waves in the ocean, and it did hear a meth lab blow up in close to London.
We were the first to know about it, probably.
Yes. If we knew what we were looking at.
That's right, yeah. We often don't know what the signal looks like from a meth lab explosion, but now we do. So are there any other new missions that are going to be studying these types of objects, like the asteroids and comets, or are there anything planned that you know of?
There are no sample return missions planned. Okay. There's currently the space mission Dawn has visited the asteroid Vesta and is going to visit the asteroid Ceres, and these are two of the largest asteroids in the asteroid belts, more like small planets. But Vesta is very interesting because we have many meteorites on the Earth that we think come from the asteroid Vesta. Mm. And in fact, these close-up observations of Vesta seem to have confirmed that these particular kinds of meteorites did actually come from a very big impact on Vesta's surface that knocked off a bunch of rock, and some of that rock has made its way to the Earth. So that's a very interesting mission. There are no plans currently for a sample return mission from a comet or from an asteroid that could really give us a good idea of what those things are made out of. We're really interested in what comets and asteroids are made out of because they haven't been changed very much since the solar system formed. So we have, of course, solar system material here on Earth, but the Earth is very massive. every part of the Earth has been melted in the past. It's been hit by meteorites. It's been changed. The rocks at the surface of the Earth aren't the same as the rocks at the center of the Earth. The Earth is what we call differentiated. The rocks that we see on Earth are very different from the original stuff that made up the solar system. So if we want to know what the Earth was built out of, we have to look at objects that are much smaller, that haven't differentiated, that haven't been changed very much since the formation of the solar system. Asteroids are pretty good for this. There are many asteroids that were small enough when they formed that they're largely unchanged from the original material of the solar system. And comets, of course, are even better because they formed very far from the sun. They didn't get very hot at all. They haven't had liquid water on them. And so the material from comets and asteroids can really tell us about what the solar system was like while it was forming. And so what the Earth was built out of, what the other planets were built out of, and what the chances are for life elsewhere in the solar system or in other star systems.
Right, because one interesting thing that's come from cometary research, and I think asteroids as well, is that there are all these amino acids out there. I think there are 72 or something like this. And everything on Earth only uses, I think it's 21?
20.
20? So that's very interesting when it comes to when you're thinking about life elsewhere. Do they use a different set, or does everyone use the same subset?
Yes, and actually one extremely interesting thing that just recently came out was the Tagish Lake meteorite, which fell here in Canada. It was searched for amino acids, and many of these amino acids were found. Now, the thing about proteins on Earth, life uses overwhelmingly what's called left-handed amino acids, and the right-handed ones are not used in life. And so people have thought maybe if we could look for left-handed amino acids, that would tell us that there might be life somewhere, if they're more left-handed than right-handed. But when they studied the Tagish Lake meteorite, which is a very primitive kind of meteorite, very unchanged since the beginning of the solar system, they found that there are more left-handed amino acids than right-handed. This seems to imply that there's some other process that can make this excess of left-handed molecules, and that maybe it has nothing to do with life. And so meteorites can tell us things like this that we need to know to look for life on other planets and other solar systems.
Interesting. Is it more as in a number, like there's 40 instead of 20 right-handed, or is it more percentage-wise?
Percentage.
Okay.
You'd expect sort of offhand that there should be equal numbers of right and left-hand. There
right.
shouldn't be any preference for one over the other. But apparently there is. So maybe 60% are left-handed. In life, it's more like 99% are left-handed. It's, okay. It's very overwhelming. But in the Tagish Lake, it wasn't even. So you can't expect it to be even just by chemical processes, right. Basically.
Interesting. There's so much we need to learn about that when we think about searching for life.
When you think how much we don't understand about life on Earth, it's very difficult to search for life other places when we don't understand about life on our own planet.
That's right. So what is the biggest misconception you find in your field of research?
Well, one thing is we love it when people look for meteorites themselves, because, of course, meteorites are our ground truth. You can look at them in the lab. But people often assume that if they see a meteor in the sky, it produced a meteorite on the ground. So after showers, we often get calls from people saying, I saw lots of meteors last night and some of them landed behind my shed. I heard them hit the ground. So most of the things, if it doesn't cast a shadow on the ground, there's no chance that it got through the atmosphere. We have a lot of atmosphere on Earth. Most of these things finish ablating 100 kilometers up. They might look close to you when you see them in the sky, but that's just because you're not used to seeing things that are 100 kilometers away. So they're actually very far away. And most of them are very small. Even a bright meteor might be only 1 centimeter. So the odds are, unless you hear a boom and a rumble like thunder, that probably it didn't hit the ground.
So if someone thinks they have found a meteorite, is there somewhere like a website they can go to that has a checklist of things they can look for? Or should they bring it in to someone to see? Or what do you suggest?
We actually have a faculty member in the Earth Science Department who is our meteorite curator here at the university. And he actually, for example, if you email a picture of the rock that you think might be a meteorite, often we can tell right away whether it might be or certainly isn't.
Okay.
And so that will save everyone some time. And if it might be, then you can bring it in, and the Earth Sciences people are usually happy to have a look at it and tell you what it is.
Okay, fantastic. Well, thanks so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
And hopefully we can talk again.
Sure.
You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
So So we just listened to my interview with Dr. Margaret Campbell Brown about her research on meteors. And one of the interesting things that came up, and that has been kind of a constant theme throughout our interviews on Western Worlds, is the fact that the group here at Western uses various instruments to detect the same object to get more information out of it. So she talks about the infrasound array, radar, optical observations with all sky cameras, and how they put all this information together to get a really well-rounded, I guess, suite of resources on these objects.
Yeah, and as she says, you have to take what you can get, right? These objects, the small ones, don't survive to the surface, and even the ones that do make it here are hard to find when they land. So you take the light and the sound and the ionization trail, whatever else you can get from these objects to try and understand them. And actually, the group here at Western has been pretty successful in setting up a system that provides continual monitoring of the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a large set of information, a lot that has been learned. It's one of the best arrangements of infrastructure that we have.
Yeah, it's pretty cool that these things are really brief flashes of light in the sky to most people, and yet, yeah, a bunch of different ways of measuring them, and there's a lot that we can learn.
Yeah, it's amazing, really, that you can get that much information out of something that lasts for maybe a second or two, right? If anyone's looked up into the night sky.
Yeah.
Right? It's those shooting stars we see, and they don't last very long, and they're very small, too.
I like the duality between the all-sky cameras to try and capture everything all the time, and then the new system with the rapidly slewing mirrors that can detect and track. That's difficult to make work, and it's working for them.
It is, yeah. And actually, I think one of the main people who is working on that is Rob Warrick here, who's a PhD student, and he's been working on that for a number of years, and it's pretty cool. I remember him testing it in the office with green laser pointers on the ceiling, and we could see on the screen that it was following it, and it was just really cool that, you know, they're able to do that, especially since these things travel so fast. I mean, you need to be able to follow them to get any sort of information out of them.
What's fun also is that after 4 or 5 billion years of evolution, this seemingly empty space in the solar system is still full of dust that the planet is plowing into all the time.
Yeah, and it's constantly refreshed, and the new stuff might even still be 100,000 years old or so.
That's right. And some of it quite a lot older. Some of this stuff has been sitting around apparently a little altered since the beginning of the solar system.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a great way for us to kind of delve into the early solar system, right? When you're looking at these objects that are pristine from early on in the solar system, right? We got old rocks on Earth, but they're not nearly as old as you can find on meteorites.
And they've been processed. They're not what they started as.
Exactly.
Yeah, the meteorites are an incredible resource for learning about the early solar system, the formation of Earth, and all the other planets and the entire solar system as a unit.
And no matter how you mean that word, they're an incredible resource that's hard to get to.
Yeah, but we still have an awful lot of them. The big ones are the most valuable, of course.
Yeah.
We chop them up and look deep in them, but there's still a lot and a big variety, too.
Yeah, and what's nice about these rocks coming to us, like you were saying, you know, we don't have to go out there to the asteroids to figure out what's going on. We can look at these smaller rocks or even the meteors that we see in the atmosphere to get an idea of what's going on.
Yeah, even some free sample return missions from Mars.
Right.
Yeah, actually one of our crew who's worked with us on Western Worlds earlier this year, we'll be going all the way to Antarctica to be looking for things that have fallen on the ice there. They're easier to find.
Yeah, it's easier to find things when they're sitting on the white snow, the white ice.
Oh, yeah, that's Marianne, of course.
Yeah.
Did a couple of interviews earlier on.
Yeah, and every year, I think they go down there for, I think it's a 6-week period, and basically hunt for meteorites. I know our supervisor, Dr. Gordon Ozinski, has done that a couple of times as well, which is pretty cool.
When it comes to finding meteorites, I really love that this is one of the fields in astronomy that really engages the public, because they can see the meteors in the sky. Of course, everyone looks up and sees a brief flash of light and wonders what that is. And a lot of people, as was mentioned in the interview, bring in meteorites and try to find them.
Meteor wrongs.
Yes. But I love that it engages people, that it brings them in.
It really brings space down to Earth, right?
Yeah.
You know, I often take meteorites into classrooms, and students and adults, really everyone of any age, loves them because, you know, when they're holding them, they're like, wow, this is something that came from space, especially if it's something from Mars or the moon.
Yeah, these are objects. Some of them are from the beginning of the solar system. Some of them are recently released from meteors. They're deep in space, you know, incredibly far away.
Yeah.
fell through the atmosphere, burned up. It's just really exciting stuff.
Yeah,
it seems that they got quite a lot of community interest when the Grimsby Fall happened a few years ago.
Right.
Not far from here.
Yeah, I mean, they put out a call for volunteers to help do a search, and they got a lot of people that were looking for it. I know that the first chunk that was found, the guy, he kept the rock because it happened to hit his windshield, and he just thought it was a regular rock, and so he kept it for insurance claim purposes. And he saw the news story on the local news saying, hey, this meteor fell, we're looking for pieces, and he called in, and sure enough, he found the biggest meteor chunk. I mean, it's just cool for the public to be able to be a part of that as well.
Yeah, and another object that was found by public searchers was the Tagish Lake meteorite. Which, as Dr. Campbell Brown mentioned, has given us some really interesting insights. It was found, it was in a very pristine condition sitting on cold lake ice. And it has given us this unfortunate revelation that you can't expect balanced chirality of those molecules, that property of being, you know, molecules with a 3D structure being having left and right-handed forms.
Right.
Which tells us an awful lot about the start of life on Earth, right? Life chose one chirality to use of the amino acids, and that tells us an awful lot. And it's something we wouldn't necessarily know if we didn't have these meteorites to check and see what is the original composition of the molecules
of the
formed
life. No idea that there were 70+ amino acids, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we only use, 21, is it? Or 20?
Yeah, you know, you can synthesize them in the lab, but you generally end up with an even balance of left and right forms.
Right.
What process is happening out there in interplanetary space that can start sorting a little bit?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to produce these molecules, even the initial formation blocks of life, and then bring them down to Earth, and then we can actually probe what they're like as just at the very start, before life started, before life got to select.
But this was seen as a slam dunk. If you could send, ESA was calling it a homochirality detector. If you could, they didn't know how to build one, but if you could send one to Mars or somewhere else, that was seen as the slam dunk for confirming that there must have been life, if there's an overabundance of one form or the other. But now apparently not. That gives us an even more difficult time trying to confirm signs of life elsewhere.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Alyssa Gilbert and Michael Forster and featured an interview by co-host Alyssa Gilbert. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Dave Kirsch, Raymond Francis, and Alyssa Gilbert. Our editors were Alyssa Gilbert, John Moores, and Michael Forster. And, as always, I'm Dr. John. You can continue the conversation online or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are @WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are Western Worlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope that you can make world enough and time for Western Worlds again next week, right here on Astronomy.fm.